from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Procter & Gamble to buy Gillette, SBC, and AT&T to merge. And news this morning, MetLife will acquire Citigroup's Travelers Life and Annuity. It's the return of the multi-billion dollar mega merger, and also the return of big layoffs, massive restructurings, and supersized companies. Years of belt tightening mean companies are sitting on cash, cash they're ready to use to merge and to reach out to markets, to you, with much more muscle. This is survival of the biggest, so get ready. Tonight on Point, the return of the mega merger and what it means for the economy and for you. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you watching your phone company, your insurance company, your razor blade supplier get gobbled up over a weekend? And when elephants dance, are we all better off or getting trampled? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight in New York with the latest on the corporate deals in the works. Dennis Berman covers mergers and acquisitions for the Wall Street Journal and joins me now. Dennis, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me. Nice to visit with you.
So you're talking about the big deal being back in a big way, and I guess each of these three deals is evidence of that.
Each one of them is in fact evidence, as you mentioned, and I guess each one in a different way. If you think about the big Procter & Gamble and Gillette deal, which is about $57 billion, that's a big number. Mm. You have to think about essentially a company coming together, two companies coming together to compete against, or I should say provide mass against, another big company. That company is Walmart. Walmart can drive such price decreases from its suppliers that P&G and Gillette, a lot of the rationale was those two would get together and provide sort of sufficient muscle back to Walmart. So essentially you have two items of substantial mass colliding into one another there.
So they've got a reason. They need leverage vis-a-vis Walmart, though your newspaper quotes the CEO of Procter & Gamble, A.G. Laffley,
yep,
saying today that the acquisition was not driven by a desire to have greater leverage with Walmart. Maybe he's just making nice with Walmart.
I think one always needs to be very nice to Walmart.
17% of Procter & Gamble's sales going there.
That's a tremendous amount, considering how big a company that is worldwide.
Now, but that may be driving them, because Walmart is cutting tougher and tougher deals. They need to have leverage to get their products, personal care and other products, on the shelves in a way that they like. What about SBC and AT&T? What's driving that one?
Well, this is a bit of a different situation. Here you have AT&T, which is a business that has been deteriorating at a rapid rate pretty much ever since the divestiture happened in 1984, so for the last 20 years.
Ma Bell broken up and downhill since then.
Ma Bell broken up and downhill since. Now, AT&T has tried a lot of different things. They launched a wireless business, which they eventually sold off itself. They tried to buy a bunch of cable companies. They accumulated too much debt and had to sell those off as well. And when wireless phone rates started getting very cheap, when long distance started getting cheaper, AT&T was really under a lot of pressure. So that deal was essentially a deal of weakness, of times changing.
Now, there's an instance with AT&T where they had a lot to do with wireless rates getting cheaper. They were the first ones to introduce digital one rate back in 1998. So in a way, they set the stage for some of their own problems.
You're right. And I guess that's just the engine and force of capitalism at work. Things you do in the past can have a nasty way of biting you back in the future. But as you mentioned before, what does this mean for people who don't necessarily worry about mergers and acquisitions, but consume the products and services of the companies that do? Well, Walmart drives cheap prices for everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go to Walmart, you might not necessarily enjoy the experience, but the prices sure are attractive. Same with wireless phone rates. Big companies coming together, AT&T doing what it did. Prices on wireless calls have gone down dramatically in the last 5 years. Your wireless bill, you probably get a lot more time for the same amount of dollars.
What about with the MetLife Travelers merger? Does that mean my life insurance is going to be cheaper as well?
I am not convinced that in fact is the case. That's more of a strategic move by Citigroup, the world's largest financial institution, to get out of the business of directly selling its own insurance.
It wasn't so long ago that they were merging toward insurance, because that was supposed to be the new thing. Banks would be full-service operations. So we had a flip and then a flop, in a way. That would seem to suggest that mergers don't always turn out to be great ideas.
Not at all. And you make a really good point. You know, what's funny about covering mergers and acquisitions is these things happen and you think they're world-changing events. But a few years later, a lot of times they're often undone. Take, for instance, AT&T buying the cable companies, bought two huge companies, hundreds of billions of dollars spent there, and they had to eventually sell them. So things come, things go, and one can never be sure what's going to stay around forever.
Dennis Berman, everyone's talking about this being an enormous year for mergers and acquisitions. Describe the underlying corporate spreadsheets that are driving that.
The spreadsheets are showing a couple of things right now. The spreadsheets are showing company balance sheets with tremendous amount of cash on them. And why do companies have cash on them? Because they've been cutting costs, they've been cutting workers, they've been cutting spending on computers and technology, and they've been saving money that way. They've been essentially driving their profits by cutting costs. Another reason things are happening now is because interest rates are at a pretty low spot right now. They might not be at their all-time low, but they're at, say, 40 or 39-year lows.
Mm-hmm.
All these things are sort of attractive to someone who is considering a deal. And there's another thing that's coming into play right now as well, and that is deals beget deals. The CEOs are not purely economic animals. They're emotional animals. Boards are the same way. There's a psychology here.
When other people start buying, I'd better buy something too?
You got it. Or not necessarily I better start buying, although that could be the case, but it's also other people are buying, so I have cover to do the buying of my own. If P&G decides now's the time to do a deal, how, if I, as a company CEO or board director, can be criticized for pursuing a similar path?
And, of course, there can be some tremendously large rewards for corporate officers in doing this. The CEO of Gillette will walk away with $153 million from his merger with Procter & Gamble.
That's right.
That's pretty big stuff, and it's not the first time he's turned that trick. Dennis Berman, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Nancy Kane. She's professor from the Harvard Business School, authority on business history, author of Brand New, How Entrepreneurs Earned Consumers' Trust from Wedgwood to Dell. Nancy Kane, great to have you here.
Great to be here, Tom.
So take us back here. Everyone's very, in the business community, very excited about this. Some employees wondering what the heck's going to happen to their futures. Consumers wondering what's going to happen to the prices and range of products they'll have available. But what about the big wave itself? The last time we saw very, very big merger activity, and this is excluding December, was pretty big in itself, but it goes back to January 2000, $237 billion in mergers that month alone, including the ill-fated AOL-Time Warner merger. And it seemed to be kind of a big sign that said, wait a minute, when you get all these big mergers, it means trouble coming, because everything fell apart after that round of mergers. Are we in a different circumstance now?
Well, I think it's back to what Dennis said. Or what Schumpeter once said, Joseph Schumpeter, the commentator on capitalism.
Some creative destruction going on.
Exactly.
Here.
Stabilized capitalism is a contradiction in terms. So there is no question that there are a variety of large-scale drivers behind these waves, from technological change to globalizing markets in the case of P&G, shifts along the power curve between distributors or retailers and manufacturers, and also, you know, a recovering stock market, cash-rich balance sheets, and I think a big question mark about what will the strategy for a new globalizing world economy that may indeed be on the uptick mean? And mergers and acquisitions are a powerful answer to that question. Not necessarily the only answer or always the right answer. There's some good studies that show half of M&A activity in 5 years isn't so beneficial to consumers, stockholders, and other constituencies. But you add in the Yentls, the matchmakers, and mm-hmm. the bankers and lawyers, and these kind of factors, and we have, you know, a kind of landscape ripe for a lot of dating and then marriage, and then at least shotgun marriages.
Now, what about that globalizing picture? Why does it make more sense for companies to become very large in the face of a globalizing economy and globalizing competition?
Well, let's take P&G, for example, the P&G Gillette marriage. You have an enormous market opening up in China. It's opening up much faster, much more robustly than anybody could have predicted.
Are they already selling Tide and Cheer and Folgers?
They are consumer products. In China, as in India, as in all developing countries, are the first thing people spend money on.
But take P&G, food, are they in there?
Take food, mm-hmm. take consumer products, take health and beauty aids.
Mm-hmm.
And those are products that all kinds of consumers at different income levels, even low income levels relative to our standards, can afford. How do you deal with a market like that? Do you go in, you know, sort of de novo and build your infrastructure and build your brands? Or do you take something like men's personal care,
mm-hmm.
where Gillette has a big play, mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. a big stake in the ground, and say, we'll go into China with an already established beachhead, or if you will, of brands, and we'll sort of hit the ground running. So I think that all these new markets and the race for consumers' hearts and heads and wallets is driving, at least in the consumer space, a lot of this activity.
Dennis Berman, you write that this can work two ways. You say a lot of sectors may see mergers in this round, this year, and more. Utilities, consumer product companies, pharmaceutical companies, business software, internet companies. But you also point out that, speaking of globalizations, that with the cheap dollar, we may see large purchases by overseas concerns of American companies in this round.
Right. What's actually interesting is that we have not seen that yet, given how weak the dollar has become in recent months. Now, just because there's a cheap dollar doesn't mean a company's going to do a deal, because when you buy a U.S. company, what are you also buying? You're buying profits that come back in dollars. So
mm-hmm.
You're buying weakened earnings.
Those lousy cheap little dollars.
well put. And so it's going to be, I think, some time before we see the Europeans really move in here. But it's only – I think it's inevitable, given if you have a set of options before you, and you have a weak dollar and a strong euro, it's a contributing factor that might push a company or two over the edge to consider something here domestically.
Nancy Kane, you talked about the power relationship, and so did Dennis Berman, between Procter & Gamble and Walmart, for example. But what about the power relationship between these huge, merged-up companies and the consumer? Does the consumer come out a winner, or does the power shift to the company? The consumer spends more, pays more, because Procter & Gamble / Gillette merged can maybe have more price control.
Well, I think that's a kind of instinctive fear. It's certainly something that's talked a lot about in antitrust legislation or in antitrust issues surrounding merger activity. I think if you look at the history of mergers, go all the way back to, you know, the late 19th and early 20th century, when waves of mergers came as rapidly and intensely as they're now buffeting our coasts or
and
our shores,
AT&T,
if you will,
among others, was buying up every little phone company.
Every little phone
country.
Company. It could find, and U.S. Steel, which was the biggest mm-hmm. merger to date, at the first billion-dollar company, you know, with J.P. Morgan acting as Yentl and kind of the matchmaker there, was, you know, of an unprecedented size and really scared contemporaries about the fact that perhaps this new larger entity would raise prices in general. Certainly with a lot of consumer products companies, that has not happened. You know, and Dennis talked very eloquently about what's happened to prices in the sort of telecom space for residential consumers.
Down and down.
And I don't think there's any reason to think that P&G and Gillette are going to use their new scale and their new scope across different product lines to raise consumers. I think the issue for consumers will be, are these brands, which are the huge bulk of assets that mm-hmm. these companies have, mm-hmm. will they remain relevant? Will they remain meaningful? Will they remain something I'm willing to spend time and money to purchase? Because that's the strategic value of a brand, that real estate, that extra value add tied versus a generic brand. And that's really a big question mark. I think, you know, loyal consumers certainly hope so. Merger and acquisition activity doesn't always bear out that 1 + 1 = 3.
Dennis Berman, how about that? Once Walmart and P&G get their computer systems all hooked up, their distribution systems all integrated, and now P&G is offering everything all the way through razor blades, is there really room for smaller players to come in here and provide competition to those big mega-mergered brands?
Well, it's a good question, and I think the P&G-Gillette merger raises questions about firms that you probably know by brand name but are struggling in the marketplace now. A company called Unilever, which is a European firm, which mm-hmm. makes, I think, a ragu spaghetti sauce, among other things. They are trying to figure out what they're going to do.
Because they're not big enough to muscle their way onto the grocery shelf where they need to be.
They're still pretty big. Mm-hmm. But given, if you take Walmart as an example, what happens between Walmart and its suppliers is that they do share information, that they have essentially a category called the brand manager. And if you are number one in a category, say razor blades, you will share and mix and match information with Walmart.
Right.
And you will essentially manage that relationship together. That sounds mm-hmm. very sort of wonky business-like. But that's how they describe it. And that managed relationship is very, very important to a bunch of big companies. And when you have that, you have power in Walmart. So does that leave room for the smaller ones? I think there will always be room for the smaller ones. But I could see the window closing a bit if you're not in that sort of brand manager, that category management.
A kind of open question there. Dennis Berman, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Enjoyed visiting with you guys.
Dennis Berman covers mergers and acquisitions for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about merger mania tonight. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Does it look good to you? Does it look good for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about merger mania and what it means for the rest of us when giant corporations become one. You can join the conversation tonight. Were you watching your phone company, your insurance company, your razor blade supplier get gobbled up last weekend? And when elephants dance, are we all better off or getting trampled? Do you care who makes your flashlight batteries, who sells your long-distance service? Are you worried that we'll end up with three big companies running everything? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Nancy Kane. She's professor of business at Harvard Business School, author, authority on business history. And right now joined from Houston, Texas by David Katz. He is a partner at the law firm Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, specializes in mergers and acquisitions. The firm advised AT&T in its merger with SBC, which was announced this weekend. It is an enormous law firm looking into the whole business of M&A activity. David Katz, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Glad I could join you.
It's great to have you. We read the headlines and we see the outcome, but tell us about the nose rubbing that goes on to get these things together. You'd be right in the middle of all that. How do these dances of merger begin? How do they get culminated?
They begin in many different ways. They can begin as they did in the Gillette situation where you have a target CEO go and visit a potential acquirer CEO and, you know, have some back and forth private discussions, and then ultimately through several starts and stops they get a deal done. You can have situations where people are worried that the transaction is not going to be well received, so people launch hostile bids to deal with that and go directly to shareholders. And you have other situations where advisors or matchmakers, you know, can put companies together where it makes sense.
Now, are there legal restrictions on the conversations that go on in advance of a formal bid? What are the parameters?
There's actually very little that stops private conversations between CEOs and others. I mean, if you own stock above certain levels, you may be restricted. But generally, the types of discussions that you would have on something like this would not be restricted. People would be worried about keeping it confidential. Because when these things become public and leak, it does make the deals much harder to do.
And what about this? We're reading about an innovation called the clean room, where consultants or others, maybe you, one step removed from the merging companies, get together and start looking at what the strategy of the merged company would be. What's that about?
Well, you know, that's really about integration. That's really about focusing what's going to happen once this deal gets announced. How are we going to deliver on everything that you know, the CEOs want to be able to promise, the synergies, the cost cutting, other things, to start looking at that. And that often follows, you know, a concurrent process as the deal may be negotiated, doing due diligence, making sure that there's nothing, no showstoppers or anything that would prevent the deal from going forward as advertised.
What about the windfalls that come to CEOs in these mergers? The CEO of Gillette in that merger with Procter & Gamble going away with $150 million plus, James Kiltz is 56 years old, and he's already made another $63 million deal on a Nabisco merger. When do when does the fine print of the CEO's compensation around merger get taken care of? When he's first hired or in the middle of the deal? How's that work?
No, generally these types of arrangements are negotiated long before any transactions on the horizon. And I think, you know, the Gillette CEO has obviously delivered enormous value for his shareholders. He's agreed, you know, in that situation to hold his stock and not exercise his options for an extended period of time, even though he's only agreed to stay on in the integration role for 12 months. But most of the time, you know, these types of arrangements are negotiated up front when somebody comes on board. And if they can deliver value to the shareholders, they can often deliver great value to themselves.
Nancy Kane, how about that piece? The big money that goes to officers in these companies, the CEO of Gillette said he didn't think it's productive to talk about his pay, but it was pretty productive for his bank account. Are these reasonable packages of compensation going to corporate officers in these giant mergers, or is there sort of, you know, hand way in the pocket on the side here? How's it look?
Historically, this is a moment of unprecedented rewards going to CEOs and corporate leaders. Unprecedented. No matter how we inflate numbers or devalue them to allow for historical price changes, the piece of corporate pie that has gone to high-level
corporate— To these individuals
is extraordinarily big. It's big and it's got lots of whipped cream on it. And we see some signs in the wake of a social contract that's been a post-war social contract that's been obliterated that people are concerned about this. Consumers are concerned about it. Voters are concerned about it. You marry that to the moment where we are right now with a lot of regulatory activity directed at corporate behavior, and it's a legitimate question mark because there does seem to be some kind of tipping point that's been reached, certainly historically in this country and certainly relative to other countries where these kind of rewards, you know, are simply not in existence and much, much smaller relative to what average workers are paid.
And David Katz, how do you look at it as a lawyer, or if let's say you're on a compensation committee, when a CEO comes into a company, if that's when these details get worked out, how do you structure their compensation so that they're adequately incentivized to be open to a merger, but not so highly incented that they're going to go for the merger, even if it's not in the shareholders' best interest?
That's a good question. I mean, the bottom line on all this is that the compensation committees need to, you know, get advice from capable advisors who can run the numbers and tell them what the different scenarios are. You want to make sure that CEOs are not going to turn their back on transactions that make sense for the shareholders. But you're right, you don't want to overcompensate them either. But in situations where, you know, it's certainly a home run for shareholders and people have invested a lot, you know, executives have invested a lot of time and effort and, you know, sometimes years at a particular company, you know, when something like this happens, the rewards are often huge. But you need to do that to attract the type of talent in today's market, and that's why these things are negotiated. The people who are on the receiving end of them generally have delivered value in the past and, you know, have worked hard to do that, and it, with proper incentives, can continue to, you know, focus on what's in the best interest to shareholders. And I frankly think that most of the time these incentives work the way they're supposed to. They focus on maximizing value for shareholders, and that's often closely aligned with maximizing value for themselves.
Okay. Of course, all the way down at the other end of the pyramid, there's the question of what's going on with the workers in these companies who aren't walking away with $150 million in a deal. I want to begin to bring our callers in, a lot of them waiting on the line. Michael's calling from Crab Orchard, Kentucky. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. All this reminds me of an Iris DeMent song, Living in the Wasteland of the Free, where the CEOs are making 400 times the average worker's pay, and now that song, 10 years old, is old. Now they're making much more than that.
So big deals are being done. A lot of money is flying around, and you're concerned?
About the worker who is still making, well, he's not making minimum wage, but $10, $12 an hour hardly survives in most, you know, city environment, certainly.
So let's look around here, Michael. You say let's look at the other leg on this stool, and we'll do that. Nancy Kane, we've talked about consumers, shareholders, and corporate officers. What about employees in these big companies when the big mergers happens?
Well, I think there's certainly a sense of anxiety about what the merger means for jobs, for whatever existing arrangements there are in terms of benefit packages, for the strategy of the company. And again, looking to history, you know, workers are smart, active, you know, agents, and are looking around. And the last two waves, beginning in 2000, and then again in the late this in late 2004 have brought a fair number of layoffs, certainly in the telecom space. Now, mm-hmm. Procter & Gamble said, you know, we're only going to lay off sort of 4,000 to 6,000 workers, and that's a relatively small percentage. You know, it's...
Well, they've got 100,000-plus employees overall.
Together, they'll be close to 150,000, so it's a very small slice of that.
But if you work for Gillette in Boston and you've just been taken over, you may feel
pretty
vulnerable.
By a company in
right
Cincinnati,
now.
You might feel very vulnerable. You mm-hmm. might feel confused and mm-hmm. vulnerable. And mm-hmm. again, we're living in a time when the post-war social contract, one in existence for 50 years, is up for grabs for a whole lot of folks, you know, earning their daily bread. And I think fear, confusion, and some sense of what does this mean for me when the executives at the top of the pyramid seem to be not only so well protected but so well rewarded is a question in a lot of people's minds.
And what about the power ratio there? Does labor, do workers become disempowered by big mergers? Does it really change their leverage with the company after that first round of layoffs that almost inevitably comes in some size?
I think that's a very good question. A lot depends on where a worker sits in what place in a particular company and how that squares with where the company's going to go. But in general, over the last 10 years, power in this economy has definitely shifted away from average white-collar and blue-collar workers towards those at the around the boardroom table.
David Katz, in Houston, when you're sitting at the table talking through these mergers with the companies, how much does the employee base come in here? What about consideration of workers?
The employees are obviously an important constituency, and consideration is given. But I think that you need to put it in the total picture, and I think you know Nancy's comment is well suited. It's more towards the social contract because I think that the boards and executives are weighing whether to do this merger or whether not to do this merger. And you know, many times if they don't, their view may very well be the strategy of the company. You know, take a company like Gillette or take a company like Procter & Gamble. If it can't do a deal like this and it's losing power in the marketplace, it may have to make greater cuts for the employees, or companies may not survive if they don't merge. So I think that part of the equation is that social contract is not there whether it's a merger or not. And I think in many circumstances, you know, mergers allow jobs to be saved that would otherwise, you know, go by the wayside. But the bottom line is, yes, employees are something that you need to deal with. You need to continue to motivate employees. If you can't motivate the employees at, you know, all the way through the organization in the context of a transaction, the transaction's going to suffer, the company's going to suffer, and the shareholders are going to suffer.
So it can cut both ways, and it has cut both ways, Nancy Kane.
It has cut both ways. Procter & Gamble has a long, it's a company that's 160 years old. It has this extraordinarily rich culture and a culture of being very, very dedicated to its employees. It has a real career path there for people of all ranks. So again, it can cut both ways, the culture of a company, its history, what the work and feel of going into your office each day is a great barometer for workers, a great way of testing that anxiety, looking at it, thinking about it, absorbing it. And in a lot of companies, as David just said, and I think in this case, in the case of Procter & Gamble and Gillette, this is a real big bet on the future. And if it works, it's going to save a whole lot of jobs and probably create a lot more over the next 10 years.
Desmond is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Desmond. You're on the air.
How are you?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind, Desmond?
You know, global mergers and globalization is on the move, and there's really no, you know, force that's going to slow that down. I think what's important is how we manage that globalization. And as we look at, you know, how companies are dispersed around, you know, the world and where they are, while mergers are great, it does make local economies and local companies shrivel, you know, if you will, and they, you know, die down.
Were you thinking smaller companies have trouble competing with them, you're saying, or they just can't play on that tier?
It's both. It's both. When you have local goods and smaller companies have to, you know, they produce those goods differently. And so their cost in general is higher, so they can't compete with, you know, with a Walmart or with the new Procter & Gamble Gillette.
Super conglomerate. Let us pick that up, Desmond. Nancy Kane, how about it? The medium, smaller companies, are they disadvantaged by this? Does it just fly above their heads and not even affect them? How do you see it?
You know, I see it actually in a slightly more in more shades of gray. I mean, if you think about the history of consumer products, for example, it's just rife with examples of small visionary entrepreneurs breaking onto landscapes that were dominated by huge players. Let's just take Starbucks, which was founded, you know, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. but really became Starbucks beginning in 1987 when mm-hmm. Howard Schultz got into it. His biggest, single biggest competitor was Procter & Gamble in the grocery store aisles making coffee.
But
know?
He came at it from such a different
and
angle.
He came at it from
matter.
Such a the creative destruction you were mm-hmm. talking about earlier, Tom, can help smaller and medium-sized players. And think of Southwest Airlines, which came onto a landscape full of big, big players.
And down they came.
And down they came, and now they're a big player themselves. So mm-hmm. I think we want to be careful before we think that bigness means that the game or the field is all closed up to small entrepreneurs or medium-sized companies, because history tells us it is definitely not.
Darcy's calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, Darcy, you're on the air.
Hi. I live in Massachusetts. I have friends that work for Gillette, and I hope that all things go well for them.
Yeah.
But when I look at my own annual budget, the cost of razors is not going to make or break the household budget. Whereas, with all the utility mergers that we've had in Massachusetts, we've not really seen those economies of scale that were supposed to come from that. And come the 1st of March, when standard offer goes away, we expect that our rates are going to go up. So I was interested in what your thoughts were on when those mergers and acquisitions are going to have the benefits on the utility side of the business that were anticipated, since that's a dollar amount that's hitting everybody's pocketbook this winter.
And it comes around every month. I guess you could stop shaving, but you can't stop paying those utility bills in the winter. Nancy Kane, how about it? The utility side.
You know, it's a really good question, and it's a question that hits all of us, right, when we get our gas bill, our oil bill, our electric bill. And I don't know exactly where those economies of scale are. I know that the disruption in energy supplies over the last three years, has thrown utility markets into great uncertainty. But I don't know how that uncertainty translates, if it does precisely, to our monthly bills, which seem to keep going up.
So just watch out. And what about the government role there, David Katz, in oversight when you have these big mergers? Is the government supposed to be looking out for consumer interest when the big companies come together, utilities in particular?
The government is looking out. I mean, I think utilities are a special case because, for example, in a lot of places, you know, you've only got one choice of a utility, and so that tends to be a more regulated industry. And, you know, the consolidation there has really focused on cost-cutting, and having, you know, a greater ability to share the costs over a larger area.
But what about phone service or insurance, let's say, things that everybody's buying and paying for?
Well, I think that in those situations, you know, the government does play less of a role, but it is still a competitive industry. The government plays a role in deciding whether or not the transaction can proceed. But if the government views that there's still a competitive marketplace, like in the insurance area or in lots of other areas, it does let these go through, and over time, you know, I do believe that the competition has benefits for the consumer. But, you know, in some cases, it's not on the promised time frames. In other cases, you know, technology changes, and that has its benefits. I mean, think about, you know, 10 years ago, an AT&T and a Baby Bell coming together was not in the cards. But now with Internet telephoning and the mobile phones and everything else, the technology has changed and created new competition that allows transactions that couldn't have occurred before to happen now.
Meanwhile, as the super mergers go forward, a company like yours ought to do pretty well in the year ahead, David Katz.
You know, we focus on
living large
and everything else, but I think that you know, these are difficult deals, and you know, we look at representing the best interest of our clients, and there are a lot of deals. There's just as many deals that don't happen as happen over time, and the good thing to try to have happen.
And when they do, whoopee-doo. David Katz, thanks a lot for being with us tonight. Great to have you.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
David Katz, a partner at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, a big player in the M&A business. We're talking about merger mania tonight. You can join the conversation. Has your job been the casualty of a mega merger? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about merger mania. Lots of mergers announced this weekend, and big ones. We're looking at what it means for the rest of us when giant corporations become one. You can join the conversation tonight. Warren Buffett made $600 million-plus when Gillette and Procter & Gamble merged. How did you make out? And what happens to competition when the big fish just get bigger? Or is that just what it takes to compete today? Does this make room for small and nimble companies? Or is it game over for the little guys? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Harvard Business School professor Nancy Kane, an authority on business history and what's going on right now. And from Chicago by Robert Filek. He's a partner in the Mergers and Acquisitions Group at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Robert Filek, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I wish you'd give us a sense of how these price tags get developed, Robert. Here we're looking at Procter & Gamble, Gillette, $55, $56 billion. SBC and AT&T, $16 billion. MetLife, Travelers, $11.5 billion. Give us a sense of how the math gets done here.
Yeah, these transactions are really based on really a strategy to create incremental shareholder value, and it typically revolves around growth. Many of the mergers you see today, companies are trying to accelerate their growth and gain power either with customers or gain new customers or gain power in the marketplace. So what you're seeing in many of these transactions is just an attempt to grow the business.
So we know they want to grow, and they've done all they can do internally to do that. They don't have a new product they've come up with on their own to do it. But still, how do you calculate a $55 billion price tag instead of $30 billion or $90 billion? Where do you come up with $55 billion? How do you begin to figure that out?
I'll tell you, Tom, one of the lessons that a lot of the companies have learned from 99 and 2000 is that you need to spend a lot of time calculating exactly what it is you want to pay. And that means you've got to have detailed plans prior to agreement on the price as to how you're going to get that value. There's a lot more rigor that goes into that process than there was, let's say, 2 or 3 years ago.
I guess I'm still trying to get at how much of it is a kind of formal calculation and how much is gut. For example, they're going to look at Gillette's annual income and do some multiple of that, but how do you decide? Is it going to be 10 times that annual or 50 times that annual?
Yeah, typically these companies spend a lot of time modeling not only the cost that they think they can take out in terms of, lower infrastructure, lower back office, less processing people, but they also spend a lot of time looking at how they think they can grow the business, combination from cross-selling their revenues to the other company's customers. And they do a lot of detailed modeling along those lines to justify those prices.
So you're saying it's mainly science? How much art is in here?
There's always art in any kind of a judgment because you don't always have perfect information in this situation, and you're usually working on a short time frame. So there's always an element of art that comes into any difficult business decision.
And when people look back at 1999, 2000, look back at the AOL Time Warner merger, supposed to be the merger of the millennium, and it was a bust. Does that make people like you, does it take your breath away and think, well, we're modeling this, but what, 3 years later, 5 years, maybe it looks like the whole thing was a bad idea?
I think the biggest change is really in the boardroom. I think as board of directors look at these transactions today, they really realize that there is a high amount of risk, and they need to be doing their diligence on making sure that the executive teams have done an appropriate amount of work to justify the price and to make a decision to move forward with the transaction.
Let's turn to our caller. Scott's calling from Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
I wonder if you folks could comment on what incents the executives today to manage to more than 3 months out or more than a year out. If stock prices and their salaries are there, of course, but also their incentive is based on stock prices.
Right.
What brings executives, what incentives do executives have to manage for 5 years out or 10 years
out? Take a little bit of a longer view and not just how can I do a quick deal that will make me a bundle. Nancy Kane, how do you see the incentives lined up?
Well, let's take A.G. Laffley, the CEO of Procter & Gamble. This is a gentleman who started at P&G well over 25 years ago. This is a man who's given his entire working life to this company. This is an institution builder. So we want to be careful when we look at these massive salaries and we look at all kinds of scandals to be very careful about who we're evaluating and in what context.
Because he can justly say, I've I've been here a long time looking out for the long term.
Yes, you bet. And being a steward for all these different brands, trying to grow them, trying to mentor people. This is a man who spends his Sunday nights not watching, 60 Minutes, but going over his top 200 reports and what their careers are doing and how he can help them.
But, that's only one model. There's the quick flip model as well.
You bet. But we have, the landscape of business is as variegated, mm-hmm. right, as any national park, and so is this one. And this is a man who is part and parcel of an institution that has been around for 16 decades. He's thinking about Procter & Gamble not two quarters out, but Procter & Gamble in 20 years.
And Robert Feilich, what about the incentives that Scott asks about? Here you've got an A.G. Lafley, someone who's been there a long time, but what about the way incentives are structured? Do you see, when you talk to high-level executives who are thinking about mergers, can you see their own personal kind of bank account ticker going in the back of their head? Or do they always or usually seem first and foremost focused on the company's well-being, even the long term, or not?
Well, I think that good incentive packages for executives align the two. So you don't see, someone trying to gain at their own kind of personal expense against the shareholders. Usually, if the plans are structured right, the shareholders' benefits and the executives' benefits are aligned. It's not typically a question of short-term versus long-term. It's really a balance of both.
Then why are packages for executives so much bigger today than they've historically been? What's going on with that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the calculations and the equity components. And, that really is what drives the long-term compensation. Incenting executives with equity gives them that long-term focus. That's the piece. And I think when companies are very successful, when you see large packages, you'll see a company that's had fantastic shareholder performance, and the shareholders benefit, as do the executives.
You better hope so, or somebody's not going to be happy. Steve's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Tom, I'm wondering if your guests see any linkage between this phenomena of increased focus on shareholder value and resulting layoffs, whether it's from a merger or just layoffs in general, and the increased individual ownership of stock in this country. I mean, it seems to me that it's fairly well documented that we have a lot more individual investors than we used to have, mostly through mutual funds, and that they're particularly focused on the short-term performance of those funds, and therefore the fund managers end up looking for companies who have the kind of focus that drives shareholder value and investment return, perhaps at the expense of employment.
That's an interesting thesis you've got there, Steve, where the individual investors themselves are kind of making the squirrel cage twirl faster because they need the return on their 401k to retire, and then, but that drives it to a shorter term horizon. I don't know, Nancy Kane. Do you see anything?
I wouldn't put those two things in a causal relationship. Hmm. I think that they both exist. They're part of, if you will, the concatenation of circumstances that global capitalism is operating under right now. They're coincident, I think, rather than causal. One of the things that's pushing the stock market towards shorter and sort of faster returns is the globalization of capital. Capital is now as mobile as information. It travels instantaneously.
So give me.
Across time zones, mm-hmm. right? So we're talking about markets that are affected not just by what P&G and Gillette do in Cincinnati and Boston, but by what's happening in China and what's happening in Bangalore and what's happening in London and what's happening in Hong Kong. And so you have white hot fluid capital that's pushing a kind of intensity to the train, speeding up the train of capitalism.
But that can lead a lot of us passengers feeling dizzy sometimes. I mean, first you're banking with company A, the next week it's company B, the next week it's company C. Everyone you do business with seems, it's just a whirl going by sometimes.
It is a whirl. It is a whirl. And by the way, our pension funds, right, are caught up in that whirl, to go back to the, our caller's comment.
If there's still anything
comment,
in them.
Mm-hmm. Right, are caught up in that whirl. I think it's exhausting. I think it's anxiety producing, and I know as a historian it is not new. If we parachute back to Chicago in the 1890s, people kept talking about, observers, journalists talking about how quickly life was moving, and this is an age when, trains traveled at 20 miles an hour,
right.
How quickly life was moving, how the only thing people were concerned with was sort of getting and spending, and how no one had any time for anything other than money.
So welcome to the roller derby. It's ever been thus.
Ever been thus. History doesn't repeat itself, said Twain, but sometimes it does rhyme.
Robert Feilich, what are you looking for in the year ahead? We've just got a minute left here. Do you see a lot more merger activity going on? Are you in the middle of helping people work out these big deals right now?
No, I think that we will see more activity, and the driver here is growth and global competition. Just like Nancy said, the global capital markets, the effect of the global capital markets on individual stock performance is very similar when you look at the consumer. Consumers are asking for higher quality and lower prices, and global competitors are willing to deliver that, and you'll see companies do mergers to try to stay competitive.
Well, there it is. It sounds like another year with all kinds of stuff going on. Watch for Marquees and business science to be changing on every business near you sometime soon. Robert Filick in Chicago, partner in mergers and acquisitions at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Great to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And Nancy Kane, professor at Harvard Business School, author of brand new Authority on Business History. Always great talking with you, Nancy. Thank you so much for being here.
A great pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, New York's Attorney General Elliot Spitzer takes on his critics. This is On Point. The nation's largest insurance brokerage house today became the latest major company to settle a lawsuit with New York's crusading Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Marsh & McLennan agreed to pay $850 million to end an investigation into charges it took payoffs from insurance companies to steer clients their way. Spitzer, a candidate for governor of New York in 2006, has become the nation's most visible prosecutor of corporate malfeasance. He's also one of the favorite targets of business groups and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, who accuse him of overstepping his authority and bullying companies into settlements to further his political ambitions. Elliot Spitzer addressed his critics earlier today in a speech at the National Press Club. Here's an excerpt of what he had to say.
Really, this is a debate about the role government should play in defining the boundaries of appropriate business ethics, defining what it means to participate in our economy and what the expectations are for our business leadership, and who is supposed to enforce those boundary lines. Now, the interesting thing about this debate is that everybody invokes the same heroes. Everybody these days, and for good reason, maybe it's because of the biographies that have just been written, harkens back to Alexander Hamilton. Everybody harkens back to Teddy Roosevelt. These are the two icons. The two individuals whom we all embrace and say they understood what government should do, they understood how the economy should function, they understood how to make the marvel of the private sector generate the wealth that we so desperately want. Now, the interesting thing is that 100 years ago is when Teddy Roosevelt was running and was elected president, of course, and he assumed the presidency after the assassination of McKinley, so he didn't run for the presidency in 1900. But 1904, 100 years ago, when he ran for the presidency, he had just had a term, or first couple years, where he had become the scourge of business. Teddy Roosevelt had attacked the cartels, attacked illegal behavior, and he was reviled by business leadership. So the irony is that those who now invoke him, if they actually looked back at what he did and what their predecessors in the business community said about him 100 years ago, perhaps would rethink their holding him out as an icon. And if any of you were to listen to their few remnant speeches that he gave that are on tape, and a friend of ours gave us some CDs of speeches, great speeches in American history, we listened to it, remarkable things that he was saying about the failure of ethics in the business leadership and the perverse effect on our economy of the cartels that he was pursuing. Now, today, 100 years later, nobody disputes that what he did 100 years ago was not only beneficial for the economy, but was absolutely necessary. And that if he had failed to attack the cartels, attack the illegal behavior, failed to open up the economy to permit true competition, then we would not have had the enormous growth that came after Teddy Roosevelt. I would suggest to you that today we're in the midst of the same debate that occurred 100 years ago, that what we have on one side is a business leadership that cloaks itself in the language of the free market, but really wants to preserve an ossified system, and they want to act against those who really support competition, transparency, and integrity. On my side of the aisle, I would suggest to you, we have folks who really understand the market, who understand what it takes to permit the market to generate the wealth that has created this marvelous economy that we have, and understand that government must step in every now and again to define the boundary lines and ensure that there is indeed integrity, transparency, and fair play.
New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer speaking earlier today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.